You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. As I've mentioned before, these podcasts are produced by reporters on NPR Science Desk, and we really don't let a holiday go by without thinking of what the science angle might be. So, Mother's Day being around the corner a couple of weeks ago, we started talking about whether women are waiting too long to become mothers. We asked NPR's Brenda Wilson to look into it, and she has our first report in today's podcast. After that, we'll hear about a new study that suggests that bipolar disorder, what used to be called manic depression, is being overdiagnosed. Then we'll hear a few brief reports on the link between sleep and obesity, about smoking bans and teenage smoking rates. And finally, we'll hear how Medicare is cracking down on some alleged abuses by insurance salesmen. As we dug into the Mother's Day story, we found that it's been 100 years since Anna Jarvis of Grafton, West Virginia, petitioned Congress for a day honoring mothers. It's also been about a century since a woman's main job was to marry and have babies. Nowadays, having a baby usually comes after education and the start of a career. But as Brenda Wilson found out, health experts are saying that many American women are waiting too long to start having children.
The average age of mothers in the U.S. has been steadily increasing. Right now, it is a little over 25. 25 is exactly the age when Emily Scrooby met Michael Boggs. She's now Emily Scrooby Boggs.
When Michael and I met, I had an IUD. I had some medical issues, and so I had to get it removed. So I was trying out to figure out what I liked and what I thought would work for me. And I tried the ring for a while, and then we were trying to be responsible and use condoms and stuff like that. But I have a baby.
When Emily discovered she was pregnant, they had only been living together 7 months. When pressed, Michael says his first response was, well...
Sorry. Wow, I mean, it's kind of disbelief, like...
We didn't talk to each other for a couple hours.
The news changed him.
You know, I'd been floating along in life, going to work, doing my job, and I was fairly good at it, but I wasn't concentrated so much on moving up. And when I found out, you know, we were pregnant, I went right to my bosses and I told them, you know, I'm ready to move up. Like, I'm, you know, life is coming and I'm ready to step up to it.
There's a best time for having a baby, biologically, and Michael and Emily hit it. But more than a third of first-time moms in the U.S. are more than 30 years old when they have their first child. Amy Harrison of Norwell, Massachusetts, says there's a good reason for that. At age 22, she was still a baby. Now at 38, she's ready.
I have a good job. I have a nice home. You know, I have a man who I'm married to who I think will be a wonderful father. I finally feel like I'm ready to give a child or, you know, children a good home.
Instead, she has endured fertility treatments and a series of miscarriages for the last 2 years.
When I look around and see these people getting pregnant at the drop of a hat by accident, it makes me very angry.
Amy, like lots of other American women, had only a vague sense of the biological clock as she made her way through her 20s and 30s.
I had this idea in my mind that, you know, as long as I try to start to get pregnant by the time I'm 38, 39, 40, I'll be fine.
Biologically, however,
fertility appears to peak for women at approximately age 22.
Dr. Marcel Cedars, a reproductive specialist at the University of California, San Francisco, says after 22, a slow decline starts, and by 35, pregnancy is much harder to achieve. 6 years ago, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine tried to warn women that they were waiting until too late to have children. But Cedars says women just didn't get it. Today, more of the women seeking fertility treatments who have never had children are older. And like Amy, they are having problems.
Each egg is more likely to be genetically abnormal. And a genetically abnormal egg is less likely to fertilize, it's less likely to develop, it's less likely to implant. If it implants, it's more likely to miscarry.
Socially, we want one thing. Biologically, we are programmed to do what we did when our human ancestors climbed down from the trees millions of years ago. Rutgers University anthropologist Helen Fisher says they've been able to determine some things from groups of hunter-gatherers who are still around.
It's thought that a girl didn't reach puberty until around age 16 or 17. They couldn't get pregnant. They were very thin. They got a great deal of exercise. It's thought that we were probably built to have about 10 years of practice at sex and love without the costs and risks of pregnancy. So she really was most likely to have her first child at around age 20.
Nowadays, young women are experimenting with sex and love in their 20s at the risk of losing out on motherhood.
Women are no longer marrying the boy that they met in high school. They're no longer marrying the boy that they went out with in college. They're concerned now about getting a career before they marry, and this takes time.
Time on the biological clock that cannot be recaptured. But there is a trend in mothering to stay at home and be a full-time mom. 59% of moms with infants stay at home. That's what Michelle Boggs Simpson, Emily's sister-in-law, is doing, but she timed everything out carefully.
And I wanted time with my husband and time still, you know, to play and, you know, get certain things out of my system, and I just wanted to be ready.
She got married, then got a degree, worked for 10 years, and stopped using birth control. A month later, she was pregnant. She was 32. When the first baby came, she quit work to raise her children.
I want to be with my children. It would break my heart to have to put them in daycare. I can't imagine. I'm very attached to my children. I mean, they're rarely with anybody but me. That's just my job. They're my responsibility.
So what about income? Is that an issue for you?
I never wanted a taste of having the double income. I didn't want to get it, because once you have it, I think you're used to it.
Michelle's sister-in-law, Emily, is doing what most mothers do, working. But home is a partnership. Emily and Michael try to share responsibility for everything but cooking, which Emily does while Michael feeds and then washes baby daughter Ada.
She's a squirmer. In the morning, it's easy to change her diaper. She'll lay there. In the evening, she's always impatient.
And Emily hasn't given up on plans for a career or travel.
We could get by on just Michael T's income, but we're much more comfortable with both incomes. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to work full-time and be away from her all the time, but I do like contributing to our income, and I like the intellectual challenge of my job. I might feel differently about that if we weren't in such an ideal childcare situation, because I leave Ada with either of her grandmothers when I'm at work.
And she works at home part of the time, connected by computer to the office. Helen Fisher of Rutgers says society will eventually catch up to the needs and biological realities of women.
You're talking to an optimist. I mean, we're seeing more and more women working from home with the computer. We're seeing the rise of women in small businesses where they can control their time. And I think that even the established business community is beginning to really realize that men and women were built to work together so that women can have their children when they're young and also sustain their career.
And that, she says, is how men and women started millions of years ago, sharing the responsibilities for feeding, protecting, and caring for the children, ensuring the reproduction of our species. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
There was a big meeting of psychiatrists across the street from NPR the other day. The American Psychiatric Association was in town, and one of the studies they presented showed that bipolar disorder is being overdiagnosed. NPR's John Hamilton looked into the study.
Bipolar disorder used to be called manic depressive illness. People who have it may swing from sad and listless to energized and euphoric, and then back again. It can be tricky to diagnose, so for the past decade, Mark Zimmerman has been studying how doctors are doing. Zimmerman works at Rhode Island Hospital and Brown University. He says at first he found that doctors tended to miss bipolar disorder. But about 6 years ago, the opposite problem began to surface.
Individuals were coming to us saying that they had previously been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and even after administering a comprehensive, thorough diagnostic interview, we were unable to find evidence of that.
So Zimmerman studied 145 people. They'd come to the hospital after someone else diagnosed them as bipolar.
About half, we did not confirm the diagnosis.
Most had some form of depression, but they didn't seem to be bipolar. To make sure, Zimmerman studied the patients' families. People who are bipolar tend to have close relatives with the same problem. But that pattern didn't hold for the people classified as misdiagnosed. Zimmerman will present his findings during a scientific session tomorrow. He says overdiagnosis is important because it can hurt people.
You don't want individuals to be treated for something that they don't have, because then they may be taking medications that they shouldn't be taking and therefore being exposed to side effects unnecessarily.
Side effects like tremor, weight gain, sedation, or liver problems. Zimmerman says he's not sure why so many people are being mistakenly put in the bipolar category these days. But one factor could be educational sessions for doctors, especially the ones sponsored by drug makers.
Almost invariably, there will be these admonitions of don't miss the diagnosis, and a citation of a number of studies in which under-recognition and under-diagnosis is highlighted.
Another scientist presenting research on misdiagnosis was Gary Sachs of Harvard. Between talks, he explained that the symptoms of bipolar disorder are a bit like the stars in a constellation.
When you see them together, you recognize the Big Dipper. If you're only going to look at one or another star, it's hopeless to sort that out.
Sachs says that in academic settings, doctors use a long and highly structured interview to identify all those stars.
On the other hand, if you were to go out into ordinary clinical practice, you would see the process is nothing like that. It's less of the formal question and more of a general discussion.
He says that can lead to overdiagnosis. It can also mean that some people who actually have bipolar disorder aren't being treated for it.
The sad reality is that when patients are treated, they lose relationships, they lose jobs, they often lose marriages, sometimes they lose their life. So there's quite a bit at stake, and it's a very serious proposition.
Sachs says there's really no excuse for diagnostic sloppiness. The tools to accurately diagnose bipolar disorder have been around for 30 years. John Hamilton, NPR News.
There are other studies making news this week. One showed that the amount of time you sleep can affect how much you weigh. We have this from NPR's Allison Aubrey.
Sleeping less than 6 hours per night or more than 9 hours per night is associated with higher rates of obesity. In door-to-door surveys with more than 80,000 people, government researchers found that about one in three of those who slept less than 6 hours a night was obese. Those who slept normal amounts, 7 to 8 hours a night, were thinner as a group. Just one in five was obese. The study also linked too little sleep with higher rates of smoking, less physical activity, and more alcohol use. Experts say this large government study is the latest to link sleep and weight. A growing body of evidence suggests that getting proper amounts of sleep may be one effective strategy for controlling weight. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Researchers in Massachusetts say that towns that ban smoking in restaurants are less likely to have teenagers who become addicted to cigarettes. NPR's Richard Knox has more.
Scientists at Boston University School of Public Health interviewed nearly 3,000 teenagers over a four-year period. Among those who lived in towns that allow smoking in restaurants, about 10% became habitual smokers. But 8% of those who lived in towns with strong smoking bans developed a cigarette habit. That might not sound like much difference, but it's a 40% reduction in the risk of cigarette addiction. The researchers say no other factor has a bigger influence on habitual smoking, including having a parent who smokes. Study authors say when teens see adults smoking in public, it seems normal. But when they don't, smoking doesn't seem socially acceptable. The study is in the archives of pediatrics and adolescent medicine. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
And finally, federal officials are cracking down again on alleged abuses in the marketing of private Medicare health plans. Here's NPR's Julie Rovner.
Medicare pays private insurance companies extra for every beneficiary who enrolls in an HMO or other private health plan. As a result, those companies have been pushing hard to sign seniors up. But that's resulted in widespread reports of abuses, from seniors being put in plans they never agreed to join to agents simply lying about what plans cover. The newly proposed rules would bar so-called cold calling and door-to-door solicitation by agents and would require companies to reduce financial incentives for agents to put seniors in plans not appropriate for their needs. Congress is also scrutinizing the Medicare private plan program, not just to stem marketing abuses, but possibly to cut back its extra funding to pay for other health care needs. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
You can hear more health coverage on your local NPR station. You can find a list of them at our website, npr.org. While you're there, if you want to find more stories about health, click on the Health and Science link over on the left side of the page. For NPR on Health, I'm Joe Neal. Thanks for listening.